And a big thanks to Darren and all the gang on 2FM Drive. It is Tuesday the 11th of March and you're listening to Game On with Andrew O'Connor. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, we're going to cross to Cheltenham where Ruby Walsh will review the Champion Hurdle Day, and we look ahead to Day 2's card as well. Niall Moran will talk Allianz Hurling League as relegation looms for Clare in soccer. Paul Curry and Mark Langdon will keep us up to date on the ongoing Champions League action and just how feasible are Manchester United's new stadium plans. We will ask the lads, and you can text us on 51552 or get us a WhatsApp message in on 087 187 9200.
This is 2FM's Game On.
And the headlines of the day so far. Today's opening day, the feature of the Cheltenham Festival was filled with drama right from the off. The favourite Constitution Hill was a faller in mid-race, and then last year's champion Stateman was well ahead of Brighter Days Ahead approaching the final hurdle, but Stateman fell and Brighter Days Ahead was badly hampered, leaving 25-1 shot Golden Ace to claim an unlikely one in the day's big race. There were three winners for Ireland in all, and we'll have lots more with that later on with Ruby. And in Gaelic games, the GAA have approved all six of the Football Review Committee's rule changes, which will be implemented for the final two games of the Allianz League competitions as the tweaks continue. In soccer, as I said, Man United plan to build a new 100,000-seater stadium close to Old Trafford within the next 5 years at a cost of just £2 billion. A bargain. And no plans on, however, how to finance the project have been disclosed, so we will investigate that in a couple of minutes' time. And of course, the Champions League, the round of 16 continues this evening, and we will have news of that in the next minute or so. And another defeat for Ireland's women at the World Amateur Boxing Championships as Dana Morehouse lost out in a 4-1 split decision to a Chinese counterpart in her 50kg class. Grainne Walsh will be the sixth of the Irish in action later this evening, seeking a first win for Ireland this week. But let us turn our attention first of all to football this evening. I'm delighted to say I'm joined in studio by Paul Curry. Happy Tuesday, Paul.
Happy Tuesday, Andrew.
And Mark Langdon, the football editor of the Racing Post, joins us as well, and Mark will join us in a couple of minutes' time. But Paul, already we have Champions League action. Benfica are visiting Barcelona. Barca had a 1-0 win in the first leg, but the second leg has started good guns. There's already been two goals.
Yeah, there has, Andrew, and it's been a brilliant opening to the game, to be honest with you. If this is a sign of things to come later tonight, it'll be in for a good evening. It is 1-1, like you mentioned. Barcelona went ahead after 11 minutes through Rafinha. It was real typical Lamine Yamal wing play down the right-hand side, turned the Benfica back four inside out, went down the right-hand side, pulled it across Rafinha at the back post to put Barcelona 1-0 ahead. But it was only 2 minutes later that Benfica got themselves back into the tie. Nicolas Otamendi.
That is a name we've
Man
heard.
City, yes. 37 years of age, still going strong at this level of European football. He was on the end of a set piece to bring Benfica back into it. So it was a really open game. It's probably more open than what we saw in the first leg.
The first leg was very cagey, that one. Barcelona just sneaked a 1-0 win, but it was sort of cagey for the whole 90 minutes.
Yeah, it was. And Barca went down to 10 men. But these two sides are have thrown up one of the best games of the Champions League already this season. They met in the league phase. It was 5-4 out in Benfica, and it was extremely open. And this game here tonight is probably more in that mould. And you would expect that Barcelona will go through, given just the firepower that they have. And we probably take it for granted how talented Lamine Yamal is at 17 years of age. They've produced some superstars in the last couple of years with Gavi and Pedri, but Lamine Yamal looks just a real, real talent for Barcelona. He's just gone from stride to stride and getting better with every sort of season and every game you see him.
Mark Langdon also joins us. Mark, happy Tuesday to you. And a great game in the first early one. Benfica now have equalised with Barca, as Paul just said, and it looks very tight.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really entertaining first 20 minutes. There's no doubt that Benfica have come to attack and that's great, I think, for the neutrals, because, you know, they're the outsiders. Barcelona have definitely got better players, but, you know, it looks like Benfica will give it a good go, and that should mean goals at both ends. We had two, and there's been other chances as well in this opening 22 minutes.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that as we go through the evening. But a couple of other very interesting games on. Let us start with the all-German tie. Bayer Leverkusen are hosting Bayern Munich, and the top two in the Bundesliga. But Munich 3 up from the first leg. And Mark, I suppose Munich will have to be confident that they're going to get over Bayer Leverkusen with a 3-goal lead going into that second leg.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. I was really surprised that the first game ended in such a wide margin, Bayern victory. They've had big problems playing against Leverkusen in recent seasons. And, you know, Leverkusen has been the better side, really, in the meetings between the two teams already this season. But everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong for Leverkusen last week. Goalkeeping error gave away a stupid penalty. Mukaleli was sent off as well. So that they find themselves in a really horrible position. You know, even beating Bayern sort of 1 or 2 nil would be difficult, but a 3-goal advantage surely is too much. And big doubt over Florian Wirtz as well, Leverkusen star player, not really been expected to start this game. So, you know, an uphill task would be sort of understating what lies ahead, I think, for Leverkusen. They've probably lost it in the first game. I don't think Munich are completely convincing defensively, and you know, in terms of them sort of going on to win the competition, I still think they need to do more to sort of stop opponents from creating chances. But you know, a 3-goal lead really mean that this second leg's you know, not too much riding on it. Really, it would take something remarkable, I think, for Leverkusen to come back.
But I suppose they'll get a bit of hope because in Bayern's last game at home in the league, they lost 3-2 to Bochum. So they have shipped 3 goals very recently. They were down to 10 men. So I suppose Leverkusen could get some a little bit of confidence from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bayern were thinking about this sort of second leg as well. I mean, there are sort of domestic performances, you know, I wouldn't sort of read too much into them. They've got a healthy lead at the top of the Bundesliga. Let's not forget Leverkusen also slipped up at the weekend as well. So I wouldn't read too much into that. I think you're trying to get the Leverkusen fans more excited than it is probably necessary, Andrew, I'd say.
Paul, you agree with Mark. It's a Bayern cakewalk.
Yeah, it would certainly seem that way. I mean, if Leverkusen are to have any chance, you would have to expect that score early, gather a bit of momentum, and then maybe hope that something happens within Bayern Munich's defence that really throws them off, or if they get a sending off. But looking at the teams last week when they played, I mean, Bayern Munich were very, very comfortable within that game. And yeah, you can take into consideration that they were beaten on the weekend, but Leverkusen probably haven't hit the same sort of heights that we were used to when we saw them last year under Xavi Alonso. And for somebody who's had such a brilliant 12-18 months, it seems like his team got a lot wrong last week, and there's just too much of a gap there to see how Leverkusen could overturn that tie.
Speaking of gaps, Paul, Inter go into the home game with Feyenoord, and they've got a 2-0 lead already, and they looked comfortable. I suppose Feyenoord looked a bit disappointing with their performance in that first leg, but Inter looked fairly comfortable in that 2-0 victory away.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only hope, I guess, you have for Feyenoord is the fact that it wasn't 3-0. Zielinski missed a penalty in that opening tie that really would have put it to bed. But Inter Milan, it's probably similar mould to the Bayern Munich Leverkusen game. You just can't see past Inter Milan. The one part of their game that has looked really you know, strong is the defensive record. They've got great experience at the back, very difficult to break down. Italian sides typically know how to see out ties and ensure they get through, and this is one where you'd expect the Serie A leaders to have far too much for Feyenoord. And they're a side, Andrew, that could go deep in this competition. They're on the right side of the draw. We've obviously seen them get to the final when they played Manchester City, but that's, you know, that defensive sort of solidity they have with Acerbi, Bastoni, even Sommer in goals, that will always give you a chance, because they've got players at the top end of the pitch who will get you a goal, and with their ability to keep clean sheets, they are certainly a side as this competition progresses that you keep your eye out on.
Mm-hmm. Mark, would you agree with that? It should be a fairly straightforward duty for Inter to get through this one.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Feyenoord missing double figures in terms of players. It seems like so many teams have got injury crises this season. I know we're going to get on to Jim Ratcliffe and kind of sort of, you know, Manchester United sort of later on, but you know, and there've been one that have had injuries. Final missing, you know, it's hard enough if they had a full strength team, but to be missing sort of 10 players is you know, makes it, I think, almost impossible for them as well. They did, of course, manage to knock out AC Milan at San Siro in the last round, but there's a big difference, I think, between even AC Milan and Inter. And Barcelona have just gone 2-1 up. Lamine Yamal has scored an absolutely brilliant goal outside of the penalty area. curled it with his left foot into the top corner. He is one special talent.
Paul, you're watching that one as well?
I am. My app is
in silence. He's watching in silence.
I'm just watching it here happen in front of me, but it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, Yamal's on the edge of the 18-yard box and he's heading away from goal, and his ability to just wrap the ball around the goalkeeper. He's just such a special talent. Like Marcus said, left foot is an absolute wand and he's just pulled an absolute worldie out there. And you think now, with that two-goal advantage, it's going to be very difficult for Benfica to claw their way back into this game. But Barcelona, with the attacking players that they have, in particular this season under Hansi Flick, are a real threat going forward. And Rafinha and Yamal contribute a hell of a lot of goals in that team.
So they're the three easy games tonight. Let us move on to the other 8 o'clock game, which is a slightly more difficult to separate these two teams. Mark, I'll let you have the first crack. Liverpool obviously went to Paris. They got beaten up for more than 90 minutes and then just got their way out. They just scored a goal out of nowhere to go 1-0 up in the tie. It's going to be difficult if Paris play the same way for Liverpool to get away with it again tonight.
Yeah, I think that the biggest there is, though, whether PSG are able to play to the same standards again. They've been brilliant in recent months domestically, and clearly I think Luis Enrique has got them playing a brand of football that is completely different, even when they had, you know, Neymar, Messi and Mbappe. Like, the balance wasn't right in the team. The work ethic is there. They've got some really talented forward players, but it's a big if them able to play the same way at Anfield that they did at the Parc des Princes. When I've watched PSG, even in recent seasons, they can be very flaky away from home. Now, Luis Enrique's managed to change the attitude in the team, but so far I've not seen enough that for a really intimidating atmosphere, they're able to go and produce it under pressure. They've already lost away to Arsenal and to Bayern Munich this season without scoring. I think they're a better team now than they were then. That was earlier on in the season. But it's sort of, I can't believe that PSG are up to it until I actually see it. And so I think that, you know, they're definitely getting better. But this is a really, I think, the next step in their development for PSG. Are they able to go to Anfield and actually step up, with a crowd against them? Haven't seen it before, so that's why I'm going for a Liverpool win. But certainly, you know, on the evidence of that first leg, this tie is definitely not over if PSG are able to kind of play to a similar level. And that's where I've got my doubt.
Paul, Irish rugby fans will tell you, or they may have told us before last Saturday, the French never travel well. Will Paris Saint-Germain travel well tonight?
Well, I expect it to be a different game than the one we saw last week, where Liverpool were very pushed back and probably happy enough to sit on the edge of their 18-yard box and allow Paris to play in front of them. You would expect with the home crowd and the energy that Liverpool play at Anfield that they're going to be more on the front foot. So I guess two sides to that, Andrew, is the PSG back four are going to be under a little more strain, I think, than what we saw last week. And there's probably weaknesses within that back four that you can get at. And you could see the likes of Salah, Diaz and Jota have more chances than they had last week. I actually thought Nuno Mendes was absolutely superb against Salah. So it'd be interesting to see whether or not he can continue that. But with that said, if Liverpool are going to press forward and put a lot more pressure on PSG, I think PSG can be very, very dangerous on transitions. Like, we saw how much pace they have at the top end of the pitch with Barcola, Dembele and Kvaratskhelia. That's my attempt at that.
It's close enough. Close enough. We'll give you the 5 points.
They can really hurt a back four, any back four in Europe, with just how much pace and power they have going forward. And it could be a case of whether or not they can take their chances that they failed to do last week. Like, obviously, Alisson was in brilliant form, but there was also opportunities there that Paris Saint-Germain probably should have taken. So it'll be fine margins again. I just think that the game and the way it played out last week will be completely different to how it's going to go this week. Liverpool are far more aggressive at home, and you would expect the energy of the home crowd to push them on. Your worry for PSG was, have they missed the boat with the amount of chances that they created last week? Can they reach those levels like Mark has mentioned? I think they've got players in there who can certainly hurt Liverpool, but you got to be a little more efficient and go in front of goal.
Mark, did Liverpool just play badly in the first leg?
Oh, I don't think they played as well as they can. And I was really surprised, even from like the first couple of minutes, they were slowing the game down and trying to run the clock down or quieten the crowd and just didn't really play their kind of own game. I think they were forced back by PSG to some extent, and then the midfield just got... I just felt that they became too wide. McAllister and Gravenberch were just not really kind of compact enough, that they were getting dragged around by that fluidity of the PSG team. So I probably lean towards the fact that PSG were very good rather than Liverpool being really bad. In the second half, we saw Liverpool go more direct, and you know, that was how they eventually got their goal. They just gave up trying to play through that really energetic PSG press and thought the best way, you know, they couldn't get through them, so they went over them. And there were moments that sort of, even before they scored, that, you know, that they started to get a sort of a better grip on the game. I didn't feel like in the second half that PSG had the same volume of chances as what they had in the first period. So I think Slot had worked it out to some extent at half time, but they definitely, I think, were surprised by just the quality of PSG in that first half. And I'd always kind of edge towards praising kind of the team that's played really good football rather than being negative about the team on the wrong end of that. It was a real battering, wasn't it? I know I'm not on the scoreline, but that first half particularly in terms of football. And had Konate been sent off, like he could have been red carded for the shove, then you would have been looking at a completely different game. But Liverpool hung in there and then nicked it.
It was a robbery last week.
Did you see the Virgil van Dijk clip of him going into the tunnel? Yeah. And the was it the sporting director?
Lewis Campos.
Was of PSG, said that should have been a penalty and a red card.
It was 100% a penalty.
And
it wasn't a penalty. I take it back, because it seemed like it was outside the box, but it was definitely a red card.
And Virgil van Dijk's response...
Yeah, this isn't Ligue 1.
This isn't Ligue 1.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, but to Mark's point, like, I would expect that Liverpool would have learned a lot from that first leg. And I think, looking at how Paris Saint-Germain play, you don't want them to settle in the first 15, 20 minutes of this game. If you allow Vitinha, Neves and Ruiz time and space in the middle of the pitch, they have more than enough quality to control possession, dictate the tempo of the game and allow Paris Saint-Germain to kind of ease their way into it. I'd say Liverpool will be far more aggressive, far more front foot, and to Mark's point, potentially a little bit more direct. Try ruffle Paris Saint-Germain a little bit more. You don't want them to settle into the game too much, and you don't want the home crowd quietening down. I would expect that Liverpool be far more aggressive and take the game to Paris Saint-Germain tonight.
Of the 3 8 o'clock games, there's no prizes for guessing which one we're all going to be watching. Mark, how do you see it actually going? What's your score prediction on it?
I'm going to go for a Liverpool to win sort of on the night 2-1 and therefore a 3-1 aggregate success. There might be a McNervy moment or two, but yeah, I'd probably just still edge towards Liverpool at home. I can't remember sort of ever sort of going against Liverpool at home in sort of big European games. Their home advantage is worth a lot, I think.
Yeah, this is Anfield. Mm. It does stand for a lot. Right, let us, before we get on to Man United and their millions, or lack thereof, let us just touch on Newcastle's victory last night, Paul, because it was an important one over West Ham United, and it brings them back level on points with Manchester City.
Yeah, very important, and really this is the conversation that we're going to be having between now and the end of the season. It looks like the three teams that came up are likely to go down, and Liverpool are obviously 15 points ahead of Arsenal. So it's all about these Champions League places and who out of probably Bournemouth up to Nottingham Forest is going to fill those places. And for Newcastle, it was a really important win. Bruno Guimaraes with the goal. Thomas Suchek missed an absolute sitter for West Ham in the first half that he probably should have put away. But Newcastle found a way to get over the line. From a kind of personal perspective, I played with Mikel Antonio while he was at Sheffield Wednesday, and it was great to see him. He was actually brought out in front of the West Ham crowd last night after the back of his car accident. So it'd be great to see him back in a West Ham shirt. And West Ham are probably in that transition period under Graham Potter now, whereby they'll see you at the end of the season and be hoping for better things come next year. But Newcastle and Eddie Howe very, very much, Andrew, in that European conversation.
Okay, Mark, speaking of car crashes, let's go to Old Trafford.
In January, the government announced its growth plans for this term, of which there were three main pillars. There was the new runway at Heathrow, there was the Oxford-Cambridge-Silicon Valley corridor, but thirdly was the regeneration of southern Manchester, Old Trafford, which was the origins of the Industrial Revolution a couple of hundred years ago. Past governments have sponsored a number of these regeneration schemes, but they've all predominantly been in and around London. You've obviously had the Olympic Village, Canary Wharf, King's Cross, Wembley, O2, a whole series of regeneration schemes, but nothing really. There have been one or two smaller ones in the north, but nothing of the scale of what we've seen in London. But this will be of it'll be the first of this scale in the north of England. The reason we're here today is that the club, Manchester United, would like to announce that we will underpin the government's growth plans with a new stadium. But it's not just a new stadium, it's a bit more than just a new stadium, because it's obvious that the more iconic or the more extraordinary that the stadium is, the more successful the regeneration scheme will be. And I think a really good example is the Eiffel Tower. Everybody knows, everyone around the world knows of the Eiffel Tower. You go to Paris, you stay in a hotel, you spend money. We have 1 billion people around the world who follow Manchester United, and they will all want to visit this stadium. Everybody in the world who's interested in football, who's interested in Manchester United, will want to come and visit this stadium. I think it will create enormous value for the north of England and for Manchester. Oxford Economics, who've done a study on it, reckon that that would be in the region of £7 billion per annum. United is the world's favourite football club, in my view. It's arguably the biggest, and it deserves a stadium befitting of its stature. The Premier League is indisputably the best football league in the world, maybe the best sports league in the world, and it must have a stadium that's at least the equal of the best in Europe. And today it has some great stadiums, but it doesn't have a Bernabeu and it doesn't have a Nou Camp. The north of England deserves to have a stadium where England can play football, where we can hold the Champions League final, and it should be a stadium that's befitting of Manchester United's stature.
So, Mark, that was Jim Ratcliffe talking about Manchester United's new plan for a brand new stadium in the Old Trafford area. And that comes on a day. We'll speak about the Gary Neville interview in a minute, but let's just talk about the stadium like the Gary Neville interview never happened. How feasible is this? And Man United have no money. Where are they going to get the £2 billion from?
Well, I mean, I was going to ask the same question. I suppose it depends how much of the £2 billion the government are sort of going to put in and are prepared to help with the regeneration of the area. Because there have been other projects, as was alluded to there, where the government have helped. I mean, you know, West Ham are playing in a stadium that was built with public money, for instance. The Etihad was helped with by Commonwealth Games. Tottenham have kind of been working with the government on their new stadium. So it would depend to how much that the government will help. But less than 24 hours ago, sort of pleading poverty and that there was no money, and then you see these designs for a new what I would say, it does look and sound spectacular, and I do, and it's very easy, I think, to sort of give Ratcliffe a boot because he doesn't come across as the most likeable character. But I do go with him on the fact that, you know, a stadium like that is something that Manchester United should be aspiring to. I was at the Bernabeu earlier on this season when Real Madrid played AC Milan, and then the new development there just makes it an astonishing arena and a cash cow as well. And I'm sure the new camp, once that's built, is going to be exactly the same. So I'm not surprised that a team like Manchester United would be interested in having a stadium like that, because I think that they would be able to fill it. They have got that worldwide support. But it was only 24 hours ago that there was no money left at Manchester United. That's what we've been told.
So they can't afford a canteen, but they're going to build a new stadium. Paul, let's now bring in the conversation he had with Gary Neville as of yesterday. So yesterday, Jim Ratcliffe sat down with Gary Neville. I think he sat down with The Telegraph and, Mark, a couple of other newspapers as well. He gave this same interview to a couple of different outlets, where basically he said that we have players who aren't good enough and they cost too much.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite bizarre, wasn't it? And so ironic that he's come out looking...
Doesn't make it any easier to sell them when you're saying they're not good enough.
No, it certainly doesn't. It certainly doesn't. But yeah, I find it hard to believe everything he's saying, that they're going to run out of cash before Christmas. Or, like, they did just spend the guts of 100 million in the transfer window, and they've obviously laid off the likes of Ashworth, and they've laid off the likes of Ten Hag, that they've you know, made those changes in recent months. So I find it hard to fathom that they'd run out of cash come Christmas if they were planned to spend as much money as they did recently. But yeah, it's a club, listen, that seems in complete turmoil. I don't know if it's a distraction from what is happening on the pitch, because I can't point to too many performances or too many players who've really improved in the last couple of months under Amorim. And he obviously name-checked a couple of players, likes of Anthony and Sancho, of poor recruitment that they've made in previous years that they're still paying for.
And Casemiro, he mentioned.
Yeah, Casemiro.
Who's now playing a fairly vital role in the middle of the park.
And Onana
was
another player that was mentioned. Yeah. So, listen, Radcliffe and his team have gone in there to try cut the fat within Manchester United, and I don't know if he wants to lay claim fame to the fact that they're running out of money in order to try help with government support to build that new stadium. But a lot of things aren't adding up over between the interview that he had with Gary Neville 24 hours ago to, okay, now we want to build a stadium worth however amount of billion.
Mark, it's an extraordinary interview to give, isn't it? I mean, it's probably unprecedented in the history of football that an owner would come out and basically diss his players so badly.
Yeah, I think it definitely was a surprise. I enjoyed it. Listened to it this morning while I was walking to work, and sort of there are some aspects of it that I do agree with. That the most being, like, he was talking about the wage bill and how important that is in football, and there is a direct correlation between sort of results and wage bill. And you know, he's been talking about the players that they've been missing and the mistakes that they've made, but then there was other things in there that you know, like Gary Neville pulled him up and said, well, you know, why couldn't the players have just raised the money that has been cut back from charity? And he said, oh, we didn't even think about that. And so you're wondering kind of, you know, who's making all of the decisions, you know, to give Ten Hag a new contract. I don't think he explained that very well. The influence that they then allowed Ten Hag to have on summer transfers, don't think he explained that particularly well either. But I think he needed to come out. I think the United fans have been wanting that kind of, they might not like the answers, but I think there'll be other sort of supporters of other teams that would wish their owners would speak out sort of at least sort of semi-regularly. And so I suppose he has to be applauded for that. But there were parts of it that sort of were quite cringe worthy. And then other bits of it that I did agree with, as Barcelona have just gone 3-1 up against Benfica. That man Rafinha, again, having a brilliant season, lengthy VAR check, but it's been given.
Okay. And yeah, just to back to the United thing, I mean, we don't keep a very close eye on English politics. We keep a sort of a half eye on it. But this is the week where the English government have announced that defence spending is going to increase so much that they're going to cut back on social services.
On the Man U back four?
No, I don't think they're going to notice the Man United back four, but maybe health and education are at risk. But that overall context is going on in the background, Mark. And days later, we hear that Man United want the government to spend $2
billion. I don't like it when football clubs sort of plead poverty and get help from government funds. I think they, you know, they should be able to do it themselves, that they get enough money from other places. I think that sort of public money should be spent on sort of public services, you know, rather than sort of these billionaires, you know, they've already got billionaires in charge. But I suppose other clubs have had some of these help from government. So United are probably sort of looking to go the same way.
It seems that maybe they've sacked their PR department, though, which might have been a good one to keep on. Let's turn back briefly to the Barcelona game. That goal has been confirmed, Paul.
Yeah, it has. So it's 3-1 to Barcelona on the night, 4-1 on aggregate.
Game over.
Yeah, it very much is. There was a VAR check, like Mark mentioned, for an offside check. Rafinha received the ball within, say, the 18-yard box, and he finished it really well. So he's, I think, got the most goal involvements ever now in the Champions League in a single season. So he's really, really lighting it up.
Lads, thank you very much for joining us. Paul is going to stay with us. We'll get some late team news later on in the programme. But Mark Langdon, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday. Enjoy Cheltenham.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, we'll do. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to talk hurling after this break.
Game On. Hurling.
Welcome back to Game On. It is 6:35 this Tuesday evening. Delighted to say I am joined by former Limerick hurler Niall Moran. Niall, happy Tuesday to you.
Same to yourself, Andrew. Hope the horses went well.
The horses didn't go well. Did they go well for you?
I can't be saying, Andrew. I work a day job there, so I wouldn't have probably got a chance to.
I work a day job as well. It's a day job. I can watch horse races. In fact, I have to. It's my job. It's terrible. Anyway, moving swiftly on, hurling, and there was some major talking points last weekend. I suppose we'll start with Clare because they had a real tonking by Cork. 15-point win for Cork. And it was disappointing for Clare, though, after their good performance against Limerick the previous week.
Yeah, I know. Look, they'll be very disappointed with the result. I suppose, look, the last time maybe they took a beating like that was 2 years ago in Ennis against Tipperary, and they came back very, very strong, and I'd expect them to do it again. But I suppose, look, the one thing I would say, Andrew, is that, like, ordinarily, like, people are probably maybe saying that they're questioning whether Clare were deserved All-Ireland champions last year on the back of their league form to date, and I, for one, would totally go against that. They were deserving All-Ireland champions by all means. There was no doubt in my mind that they deserved to win the All-Ireland, but what I would maybe argue is that, like, oftentimes when a team win an All-Ireland, they tend to get a bounce in the following year, and I'm just not so sure Clare are going to get that same bounce, given not even so much their age profile, but given what they had gone through in order to maybe win their All-Ireland. And I suppose just the last day, I thought they just looked a little bit leggy. And look, that'll be the biggest concern. The results, I think they'll get over. It's just the legginess of them is something that might be of concern to them, like, you know. And look, and I suppose in the same breath, like, Cork, 6 goals, really, really look sharp. Declan Dalton, obviously 2-6, he'd a fine game. I suppose Dermot Healy's performance last week maybe put the pressure on the likes of Declan to say, hold up a second, I need to keep on motoring. And again, I suppose, look at us, that Shane Barrett again was immense. And I suppose his goal after 10 minutes, that really set the tone.
Now, Cork are good. We're probably not giving them enough credit, but they look good this year.
They look good every year. I know. They're really, really coming strong. I just think the volume of numbers that they have, I think really they've taken another step forward from last year's All-Ireland, having let it derail them. And look, even in Sunday's game, like, there were 3 goals up at half-time. Do you know what I mean? They went 18 points up there at a stage. They're very, very potent forwards. A lot of pace throughout. And look, I'm not saying anything that people don't already know. They're obviously huge contenders for both Munster and All-Ireland banners. But look, as I said, I would expect Clare to really, really come back strong. I just, the only concern that they would have had maybe was just they looked a little bit leggy. And truth be known, even at times against in the early parts of the game against Limerick last week, even though they went down and won it, I thought for a part of it that they looked extremely leggy in the first 15-20 minutes. So look, maybe their timeline was probably a little bit different to last year as well. So they're still All-Ireland champions, they deserve All-Ireland champions, and again, it'll take a very good team to beat them, but it will give hope to some of the other teams in Munster, especially if you're to ask me, if in betting parlance, the dark horse, I just watching Waterford from a distance, I just think that they've gotten promoted, obviously, from 1B. I think they have an awful lot of players back, like Austin Gleeson returned to action last week, Conor Prunty is back in full fitness, Tyke the Bourke is due back, like the Ballygunner boys, you'd imagine, are a lot fresher. So Desi and you know, Kevin O'Mahony did a lot of damage last day. And I just think for Clare, that could be really the acid test for them when they go down to play them in Walsh Park. And I think there could be a lot riding on it when that game comes around.
And the 7 goals against Westmeath helped Waterford as well, but they're really fine in the back of the net.
Yeah, look, as I said to you, they're doing it all the way from Broadway. Do you know what I mean? They've achieved their goal despite an horrendous start against Carlow in the first round. They've achieved their goal. They've been promoted. But it's just the number of players that they've come back. And I said it there last week. I just think their age profile, I think where they're at as a group, I think for a lot of them, this is probably Custer's last stand to build on that prominence that they would have had in the early 2010s. So, look, I suppose the real eye-catching result from Division 1B was maybe Antrim's results.
Yeah,
a huge
and
win.
They seemed to overcome. There was a lot of sickness in the camp, but they seem to overcome the sickness with a big win over Laois.
Yeah, I tell you, given the sickness that they had, they could do with sending their team doctor over to visit the Pope over in the Vatican. He won't be long coming out of his slumber. Jesus, the situation during the week where they had 14 or 15 lads that were, so I won't call it on death's door, but weren't going to be playing. And then you turn around and you put your best performance of the year together. Look, as I said, obviously, look, they needed a performance, and look, I'm sure they had a virus running through it. It wouldn't be like Davy to make up anything, but as in, like, I suppose, look, it's very, very positive for them. I think for Laois, they got off to probably a poor start against the wind, and they found themselves 13 down at half time. And look, I think for Antrim, when you're devoid of confidence, when you get that kind of head start, it means an awful lot. And I suppose, look, James McNaughton has built his form from last year. So look, that's Davey off to a bit of a start now, like, you know what I mean? And get a little bit of momentum. And like I said there last week, they're probably getting guys back. And that'll be very, very important to them. And I suppose in the other game then, like, another team who you could argue so far have been the unluckiest team in the league have been Dublin. And, like, do you know what I mean? It wouldn't have taken very much for them to win those games against Offaly and Waterford. And they were the architects of their own downfall. They have 35 players using the league. They racked up 229. An awful lot of guys come back into it. Like, Danny Sutcliffe is back. Conor McHugh made his bow. Like, they have very, very good forwards. They have a team backbone by Nafina, going to be All-Ireland champions. And again, I think they represent dangerous opposition in Leinster, especially in a situation where both Kilkenny and Galway, Wexford, they're all struggling for form. And I think Dublin will, even though they mightn't have achieved their first goal of the year per se and getting promoted, I do think they represent dangerous opposition. So for me, I just think there's two teams coming out of that 1B that we mightn't have heard a lot about. I do think they're going to have a lot to say in the round robin stages of the championship.
Okay, I'm going to limit you to about a minute because we have to cross over to your nemesis, Ruby Walsh, in Prestbury Park in a minute. But before I do, Kilkenny and Tip, 4 red cards and a 9-point Tip victory.
Yeah, they have had a lot of sending offs over there. I know the last year's minor final was the same. Look, I suppose the nature of sending offs, I suppose dubious one, Alan Tynan. I thought the three Kilkenny ones, I thought the ref, in fairness, I thought he did get it right. In real time, I thought he got it right. And I suppose if the word is coming out from Croke Park at the moment, like, if it's head, it's red. And so it's like that. So they have to be conscious of it. Again, Tipperary, very, very positive, really clinical in their shooting, looked a lot more leggy in terms of, like, a lot more going from legs wise. And so that comes with the change of personnel. Maybe Kilkenny will be disappointed. No score from play probably till the 15th minute. And even then, when they got level after about 20 minutes, Tip hit the next 5 scores, which is very uncharacteristic of Kilkenny. But again, their down players, and I come back to it, it's just the inconsistency of their play is the one thing that will bother them. And look, I suppose finally, maybe in the other game, Limerick obviously did very well against Galway. A concern for Galway there, in, like, Sean, they only scored 8 points in play. Limerick scored 123 from play. Big difference in that. And I know, look, they're still trying to find players. So again, time is running out now. We're 5 weeks out, and John, the weather is picking up, and the excitement is gathering. Once Cheltenham is over, it's full steam ahead for hurling.
Niall, thanks very much for joining us on Game On, and get your pen and paper out, because after this break we're going to get a review of the day from Ruby Walsh and all the tips for tomorrow.
Game On Racing.
Welcome back to Game On. It is 6:45, and we're going to go to Prestbury Park and talk to Ruby Walsh in just a minute. But let us first hear about the big race. The feature of the day was the Champion Hurdle, and it was one of the most dramatic Champion Hurdles ever. Constitution Hill, trained by Nicky Henderson, went off the very, very short price favourite, and he fell early in the race, and then State Man took over, and this happened.
The State Man is cruising to the outside. He is indeed the forgotten horse of this year's Champion Hurdle. He's got the sheepskin cheek pieces on for the first time to sharpen him up. Paul Towner moves him out of the slipstream of brighter days ahead. Away he goes, down to the last of the Univet Champion Hurdle on 5 Live.
Yes, Paul Towner kicks for home. Last year's winner, State Man, has taken about 4 or 5 lengths out of this field with the mares in second and third. Golden Ace now second. A State Man is down, has fallen at the final hurdle with the Champion Hurdle. His at the taking. State Man out of the race, and that has left Golden Ace in front. Oh, this is drama. How much can we take? Golden Ace will take the Champion Hurdle. A mare has won it, but we didn't consider it would be this fun. Golden Ace wins the Champion Hurdle. Burdett Road second, Winter Fog in third, followed by Brighter Days ahead, and then King of Kingsfield, Charlie Post. I need a lie down.
Willie, you've spoken to Paul in there. Just a word about what's happened.
He was just too long and caught the top of it. And same as any power, I think. These things, you don't think two Champion Hurdles are going to fall in Champion Hurdle on the same day. You know, it's extraordinary stuff. But one of them are Jeremy, Scott, and Golden Ace.
Golden Ace,
yeah. And, so fantastic to have a winner like that when all that's happened. And, they came, they punched, they tried, and they're there to be jumped. We can't say anything. Just delighted both horses and riders are safe.
Absolutely.
And that's the important thing.
You've seen so much. You've seen, 100-plus winners at the Cheltenham Festival. Have you ever seen anything quite like that in a Champion Hurdle?
Any power, no? Well, she was in the Mayor's Hurdle. Yeah, well, I don't know. We've just... You know, there's... We've known last hurdle fence followers here before, so we're used to it at this stage. It's what happens, and what can we say? Just everyone is good, and a very popular winner. So that's, racing is good for us.
Appreciate you coming to talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was losing trainer Willie Mullins after a very dramatic champion hurdle. And I'm delighted to say we are joined, as we will every day this week, by Ruby Walsh, who is at Prestbury Park. Ruby, what a dramatic day and what a dramatic champion hurdle.
Oh, my God. It most certainly was that, Andrew. I mean, if you could have foreseen what was going to happen in this champion hurdle, you are a mind reader. But look, brighter days ahead, and booked out King of Kings to the wind, a good gallop. They got to the fourth last, Constitution Hill, stepped into the front of the hurdle and tripped himself up. Brighter days ahead took over coming down the hill. She fell in the hole at the second last, and Stateman arrived to win the race, quickened up off the bend, got to the last hurdle. Yeah, he was a bit far back from it. Paul Townend sent him forward. He just clipped the top bar with his front feet, and over he turned, and it was all left then to Golden Ace. But it's the unpredictability of sport, but it doesn't half show you that if you don't buy a lotto ticket, you can't win the lotto.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let us go back to the first race, because there was success for Willie in that one with Kopech de Bordes in the Michael O'Sullivan Supreme Novices Hurdle. And it was a great way for Willie and for Paul Townend to get the festival underway.
It was a brilliant start for them and for the McCarthys, and for Charlie McCarthy in particular, who had a kidney removed a month ago, who owns the horse, suffering from cancer. And obviously he's over that operation, and look at the emotion and the joy in his face after the race. But Kopech de Bordes is a good winner, a million money, finished second, and it was a flying start for the Irish, Andrew, but it kind of went a bit downhill after that.
It did. The next race, obviously, the punters were all on Madgeborough, but it was Django Bale who timed his run to perfection and just pipped everyone on the line.
Yeah, Madgeborough made a bad mistake at the last ditch. And again, then at the second last fence, he never got off the ground and did the splits. He literally sat down and did well to get himself back in the contest. It looked like Lord of Sud maybe was going to win, then only by night. But Django Bale came from the clouds under Nico de Bonneville for Nicky Henderson and robbed all the spoils. And that was the kind of story of the day, wasn't it? The unexpected ones cropping up and winning the big races.
Now, it was expected that the English home horses would dominate the handicaps. And the Ultima, I suppose a lot of people were looking at Changing Man, but he can only manage second place. It was Mirtown who came up trumps at a price of 13-2.
Yeah, for Patrick Wodge and Lucinda Russell, Scottish trained horse, only a novice, jumped like a buck, made a mistake at the fifth last fence, but other than that, his jumping was amazing to watch. Big day for Patrick Wodge as well, Ridey's first winner at the Cheltenham Festival, and, you know, in the High Senior colours, Lucinda Russell was on the board of Mirtown, and a horse herself and Peter Scudamore have always liked, and they had him really well handicapped for the occasion.
Now, there was a lot of talk yesterday about Lossie Mout not going in the champion hurdle. She was switched into the mare's hurdle, and maybe that was a mistake. Maybe she would have won the champion hurdle on the day, but you couldn't have predicted that two champion hurdlers would have fallen. But she did romp home in the mare's, and she looked comfortable.
She did romp home in the mares. I think the pace of the race really suited her. She travelled really well. Jade de Grugy didn't go that quick in front, and Lossie Mout was able to sprint out past her on the run to the last to land a second mare's hurdle. Look, people will say she might have won the champion hurdle. Maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't, but she ran in the mare's hurdle and she's the winner of that, and that's the way it is.
That is the way it is. And then the Fred Winter, and there was a lot of applauding, and a lot of people putting your hands together, and a great victory for Joseph O'Brien.
It was Put Your Hands Together, who travelled brilliantly for Mark Walsh, and a bit of compensation for him after Majbury's defeat in the Arkell. But Put Your Hands Together on the drier surface here at Cheltenham always looked, it was sticking out like a sore thumb from so far out, all the way down the hill. Put Your Hands Together was cantering quick. A good winner for Joseph O'Brien and for Mark Walsh and JP McManus as well.
Did you get to see the last Haiti Couleurs romped home in that last race?
It was, yeah, and it was a race that wasn't short of drama too. Plenty of fallers in that, but Haiti Couleur for Rebecca Curtis in Wales under Sam Jones. The winners have really been spread around this afternoon, weren't they? Scottish, English, Irish and Welsh all in the winners' enclosure, and Haiti Couleur was really game in the last.
Right, let's switch our attention to tomorrow, Ruby. And I suppose the Champion Chase is the big race of the day. John Bond, another JP McManus runner, he will probably get the nod in terms of favourites there.
He will, and I think he looks rock solid. People are questioning his form at Cheltenham, but to be honest with you, Andrew, I think he comes to this particular festival in outstanding form. Look, he won the Schlur Chase here in November, he went to Tingle Creek and Sandown in December, and then he won the Clarence House at Ascot in January. He looks rock solid. I just think he's a better horse than the opposition, and he's going to be really hard to beat, and the ground will really suit him. It's going to be too quick for Enna Gramine. It probably will suit Marine National, but I think he has to improve a bit to get up to John Bond's level.
Now back to the start, the Turner's Novices Hurdle, and I see a Final Demand is now the favourite for that one, and another Paul Townend and Willie Mullins' chance to get another good start for day two.
Yeah, and hopefully he can. He was a really impressive winner at the DRF. He faces the new Lion from Dan Skelton's yard, and he also has the Yellow Clay from Gordon Elliott's. But look, we really like Final Demand. I thought he was impressive at Leopardstown. He should handle the ground. I just hope they go a good gallop. I think he needs a good gallop. He's a strong stare, and I think if they go fast enough, I think he's the best horse. I hope he is anyway, Andrew.
Now, the Browns advisory, there's three horses that are dominating the prices as well, and a lot of punters are looking at those, and they're well out ahead in terms of the prices. Ballyburn, Dancing City and Better Days Ahead are the shorter priced horses in that one.
They are, and I guess if you look last year when they were hurdlers, Ballyburn won the Turner's Novices Hurdle, Better Days Ahead won the Martin Pipe, which is a handicap hurdle, and Dancing City was third in the Alba Bartlett Novices Chase. And look, to me, once you jump, when you go chasing, if you're the best novice hurdler, to me, you're going to be the best novice chaser as well. So I'm in the Ballyburn camp because I think he was the best of these as a hurdler.
And the Carroll Cup as well is a difficult one to sort of read. Be Aware and Bunting and Impose Toi are, I suppose, the ones at the top of the market.
It is, yeah. Not surprising that a bookmaker sponsors this one, Andrew. It's a really tricky contest, 26 runners. You need a lot of luck in it. Be Aware ran really well here in November in the Great Wood. That was a cracking run behind Burdett Road. Bunting ran okay in last year's Triumph and a good comeback run in Clonmel. Impose Toi is always banging on the door. So too will Comfort Zone. But at a push, maybe Jimmy Desai, Maxim. You could throw a load of horses into this, Andrew. It's a really tricky contest, and not one I have a strong opinion on.
And speaking of tricky contests, the cross country as well is probably one to let watch and not put your hand near your pocket.
I don't know that. Plenty of people really fancy Stumptown. I'd be a big fan of Vanillier's. Galvin has a good chance, but I like Vanillier. Blinkers seem to really make a man of him at Punchestown in his last start when he won the P.P. Hogan cross-country chase at Punchestown, and I'm in the Vanillier camp.
Moving on then to the grand annual, the second last race of tomorrow. An unexpected party for someone, but who will it be?
Yeah, and by all accounts on the racetrack anyway, unexpected party for the Skelton seems to have turned the corner and taken off in recent weeks, so you'd have to give him an outstanding chance, unexpected party. One of the big price, Andrew, that could run well is third time lucky.
Okay, and any fancies in the last race of the day? I know a lot of people are looking at Copacabana.
Yeah, I'd be with Copacabana too. He really impressed me at Navan. I thought that was a hell of a good performance, and I hope he can deliver in the lucky last and make it a lucky last, not an unlucky one.
And Ruby, a lot of talk today about the handicaps and the way the English handicapper deals with the Irish horses. Do you think it's as fair as it has been in previous years, or is it too unbalanced now?
I don't know, Andrew. Handicapping is an opinion. Handicappers are the only people in either the IHRB or the BHA, the governing bodies in both jurisdictions, who have an opinion. Handicapping is an opinion, and that's the way the British handicappers choose to predict the races. Their job is to try and make them fair for everybody, but I'm not so sure. I think Put Your Hands Together won the Fred Winter, the Fred Winter, so I don't think the Irish can complain too much.
You've been at a lot of Cheltenham festivals. How did today compare in terms of atmosphere? And I know the sun shining always helps everyone.
It does, and it was a great crowd. Obviously, the crowd was down a little bit, but there was great atmosphere. I mean, to watch the cheer that Jeremy Scott got when Golden Ace won the champion hurdle, to see the enclosure singing almost like a football stadium, I mean, that's very rare at a race course. I think a lot of people enjoyed today. I think there was a great atmosphere. There were strange races, strange results, but I guess that's the, I'm not going to say the beauty because it's the wrong word, but that's the unpredictability of jump racing. And jump racing, you got to jump in to win, Andrew. I know that better than anybody else.
And I suppose that's why we keep watching. What is the weather forecast like? Can we expect the same sort of good to soft ground as we did today?
I think we can. The forecast is for it to get a lot colder, though. And it wasn't, the sun was shining today, but I think their temperatures are going to take a big drop. So I'll have to get the thermals out for tomorrow.
You'll have the gloves and hat on. All right, well, listen, thank you very much for joining us, and we will speak to you tomorrow evening.
Cheers, Andrew.
Thanks, Ruby.
Game on. Racing.
Now, just time to tell you that Barcelona still lead Benfica 3-1 on the night, 4-1 on aggregate, and Paul Curry is still here, and we've got Liverpool PSG team news.
Yeah, no real surprises, Andrew, for either side. No changes from the teams that played last week. So Paris Saint-Germain, who made 8 changes on the weekend for the Ligue 1 game, back to full strength tonight, and Liverpool going with the same 11, so two heavyweights going at it.
Lovely. Yeah, the kickoff is at 8 o'clock in Anfield. Thanks to our production team here, Ronan Lawler, Laurie Lee Davis and Taran O'Sullivan. The brilliant Beda Da Silva is up next with a new music show, and Shane Dawson is back on Game On tomorrow night from 6 o'clock.